Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
Many people in neurosciences not only would like to know what other people are doing in other disciplines, but they have to know in terms of understanding the Earth as a system. That actually one way of describing this new approach would be Earth system science rather than just Earth science.
I think in the short term, what we can do right away is alternative fuels ranging from various forms of natural gas right away. Then it seems to me we want a longer-term focus on solar energy and hydrogen. There's no reason why we shouldn't have on the market now a whole generation of solar-powered automobiles. There's no reason why we can't more aggressively pursue hydrogen. We have fallen way behind on both fronts, hydrogen and solar.
John Katzenberger, director of the Aspen Institute for Global Change. He says education and interdisciplinary communication is the key to understanding the environmental problems the globe now faces. And Senator Tim Wirth, he's working hard to get the U.S. a national energy policy and has been doing so for 4 long years. Those stories and much more this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Dan Brody sitting in for Bruce Robertson. The serious conflict in the Middle East raises concerns about our national consumption of energy, and it increases the urgency for the development and implementation of possible alternative sources of energy. While for many of us such concerns may be relatively new, Senator Tim Wirth, a Democrat from Colorado, has been working to pass his National Energy Policy Act for 4 years. We spoke to him about his worries and his plans.
There is going to be no single, simple, quick-shot answer to the energy issues. The fact that the Reagan administration and then the Bush administration totally abandoned any commitment to energy is going to make it now more difficult. We're going to have to take a number of significant steps, one of those obviously being conservation, to develop automobiles that are more efficient than the ones we have now. Our transportation industry, particularly automobiles, is the greatest consumer of oil, and that's the greatest opportunity that we have. We also have to aggressively pursue alternative energy programs ranging all the way from solar energy to hydrogen. And at the same time, we're going to have to develop programs for alternative fuels for vehicles like using natural gas. All of these are items that are, you know, everybody, you know and I know and anybody who's looked at the situation knows that we ought to do this. Unfortunately, we still have this significant resistance from the White House.
Wirth argues that we must aggressively make use of the new technologies available to us as a nation, and in doing so, develop better uses of alternative sources of energy.
I think in the short term, what we can do right away is alternative fuels ranging from various forms of natural gas right away. Then it seems to me we want a longer-term focus on solar energy and hydrogen. There's no reason why we shouldn't have on the market now a whole generation of solar-powered automobiles. There's no reason why we can't more aggressively pursue hydrogen. We have fallen way behind on both fronts, hydrogen and solar, far behind, for example, the Germans and the Japanese, who are taking the technologies we developed in the 70s. And because of the neglect and the refusal of the Bush and Reagan people to look at this, have taken our technologies and are now developing them. Let's bring that technology back home again.
In an effort to bring the U.S. back into the alternative energy race, Wirth has introduced the National Energy Policy Act. The legislation, he says, is an effort to not only positively affect the U.S. environment, but the entire globe's.
4 years ago, I introduced this legislation on national energy policy, which was really focused on global warming and global climate change. It's very clear that there is a direct correlation between the changes in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere and global warming, and energy policy. And if we are to develop a more rational energy policy with conservation and alternative energy programs, that will have a very significant benign effect on global warming and on the overall environment. So the original purpose of the legislation was a combination of environmental and energy policy. I hope now that with the crisis in the Middle East, that maybe we will push the administration, the president and John Sununu and Dick Darman, into understanding that benign neglect or deregulation is not an energy policy in any way, and that maybe they will once again focus on the need for us as a country to become more energy independent.
The legislation is aimed at increasing environmentally conscious energy usage by emphasizing the need to make use of alternative energy. The program's influences would range from new requirements of federal agencies to new programs which would most likely affect all of us.
At the top, the Department of Energy is required to prepare plans for greenhouse gas emissions and how we're going to lower the production of greenhouse gases in the United States. Legislation then moves to a variety of efficiency programs in buildings, industry sectors, development of a home energy rating system. So when you buy a house, you know what the efficiency of that house is going to be. Utility policy changes to encourage energy conservation. The legislation also encourages a variety of joint ventures with the private sector in five key industrial areas like steel and glass and aluminum. It then moves on to developing a series of transportation programs with natural gas, with mass transit retrofits and commercial fleets and so on. There's a section in the bill on electric vehicles. There's a section helping the solar energy, large-scale solar development programs. There's a section on hydrogen fuels, and there's a section on fuel cells and chemical energy. So it's a very comprehensive, broad-reaching piece of policy and research legislation. It's a start. It's no means the panacea, but it's a start.
One might think that such legislation would be welcomed with open arms and quickly pass both the Congress and the White House. But as Worth explains, there is strong opposition from influential industries.
The automobile industry, of course, doesn't want to make any changes at all. The big oil companies are threatened every time you mention any kind of an alternative program or any time you say the world environment. And so obviously they will get together and oppose this just as they got together and opposed the Clean Air Act.
As with most legislation, there is also the issue of the price tag. Worth says that adopting his policy would cost between $4.5 and $5 billion a year above what we now spend in the area of energy. But he says that we must contrast that cost with the cost of not developing alternative sources of energy and continuing to be the victim of the oil holders abroad. For The Environment Show, this is Dan Brody. As concern for the environment is raised, more and more schools are including environmental education into their curriculum. But developing effective programs is not as easy as it may seem. Joanne Heidelberg is the Executive Vice President of the North American Association for Environmental Education, an organization which was designed as a networking system for professionals in the environmental education field. She says the communication is essential.
We put people in contact with each other who have problems relating to environmental education. Our major focus annually is a conference, and we have this conference in various locations throughout North America. This next one will be November the 2nd through the 7th in San Antonio, Texas, and we expect to attract about 500 to 600 environmental educators from all over the world. We'll have over 200 presentations, including in addition to symposia, workshops, field trips, global briefings, a whole array of topics relating to environmental education in all facets. And so we will be working, presenting this to the educators for their information and growth and development.
In these conferences, I imagine you have a lot of contact with all of these educators and get to speak to them a lot about what's going on in their schools.
Right.
What is going on? What do you hear from them?
Well, what I hear from them is that this year is certainly the year of the environment, that there is an increased thrust in the schools and in the non-formal sector as well in presenting environmental education programs. And this includes everything from nature study and the environment from that level to toxic waste and the ozone layer. So there's a tremendous increase, I feel, in the attention to the environment.
This increase in attention about environmental issues, Heidelberg feels, is the key to solving environmental problems. She says the goal of her association is to incorporate environmental education into all facets of our lifelong educational process.
We work with all ages. Right now we're working a lot with the children, but that doesn't mean that we aren't working with the senior citizens as well. And it's something that we do every day. It's a way of life. It's something that I don't feel should be a separate curriculum within a school system. It should be a part of art. It should be a part of math. It should be part of social studies, because it's all interrelated. And I think that this is maybe one thing that NAAEE is trying to promote. Actually, our mission is to promote a healthy and sustainable environment through education. I think that education is the key. If we I mean this in every sense of the word, not just the formal, but every sense of the word, that education is the thing that's going to help save our environment.
Heidelberg says that although she can definitely see attention and awareness of the environment on the rise in youngsters, it is still too early to tell if the kids who have had this new education will become more environmentally active after they get out of school. But she says there are definitely visible effects.
I see it here in our area with children that are beginning to tell their parents, you know, we've got to recycle, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, we've got to save this planet. So I'm seeing that the younger people are much, in my opinion, are much more aware of problems and are trying to do something to correct them. And I think they're doing a good job of educating the adults. And, you know, it's kind of hard to turn your six-year-old off. So I think they are responding somewhat out of a necessity, as well as I think that they're beginning to be more concerned generally.
According to Heidelberg, the development of a good environmental curriculum has been slow-going, because of both a lack of funding as well as a lack of time for teachers to figure out what curriculum will work. In response to this problem, the association is currently working on a publication to bring together what is currently known to be the best techniques.
We're hoping to be able to bring together all of these curricula, do some type of evaluation, and put together a publication that we will be able to disseminate to environmental educators throughout the country. And the reason for this is because there is so much out there, and teachers have so little time to find out about it, and they really have less time to try to develop something in their community. So we want to be able to share this throughout the educational community. What works in Tampa, Florida, for instance, may not work at all in Central Ohio, but there may be some things that they can draw on. And having this information available will be sure that we don't reinvent the wheel.
Although concern for the environment has been a strong part of our society since the early 1970s, Heidelberg sees more hope for today's education-centered movement than yesterday's activist approach.
Well, during the 1970s, during the first Earth Day period, and during that time of in our development, there was a big push to do something about the environment. But the push was more or less, in my opinion, an activist type of approach, which tended to turn a lot of people off. And the political system didn't do very much about it. I think at this point we're more into the educational component. And I think that with more and more voices being heard, we've got to talk to our political people and get more resources. I think there's a lot of work being done. I think there's an awful lot of curricula. There are a lot of people that are doing things in the classroom on next to nothing budgets. And they also have such a tremendous amount of paperwork that they really can't do their work. What they need is some time to really teach and bring these things into the classroom.
I'm just wondering if these children can have more of an effect than the adults in terms of influencing politicians and getting the funding that is needed for these programs. Has there been any of that sort of activity?
I read recently, and I'm not sure where I read this, that there was a school group that a group of children that decided they didn't want to use styrofoam in their cafeteria any longer. So they had a strike, a sit-down strike, and not no styrofoam in the cafeteria, and it turned the school board around. So, yes, I do think that the children can have a great influence on the political situation.
So the future, at least as Heidelberg sees it, is a positive one, full of young adults who are well-educated about environmental issues. She says it is important for all of us to think globally and act locally. For the Environment Show, this is Dan Brody. The place to start is to take stock of the Earth. What do we know? What don't we know? What must we learn more about? And how do we act so as to chart a course for the 21st century that leads to a sustainable future? Such are some of the questions asked by the Aspen Global Change Institute, which now serves as a source of information on global change. John Katzenberger, director of the Institute, explains how it all began.
The Institute began in 1988 as an idea. Rick Chappell from the Marshall Space Flight Center at NASA was in Aspen for a conference, and he works in the Earth Sciences Division of NASA and was interested in providing a forum for Earth scientists of many disciplines to come together and learn what activities are going on across disciplines. And do so in an informal setting where there could be a lot of discussion and dialogue and a break basically from the normal type of conference you might go to for 3 or 4 days, but have a more in-depth period of time, perhaps 2 or 3 weeks. So that was the basic premise as it started. And coupled to that was the notion that interesting ideas and things that were discussed could then be shared the remainder of the year through an outreach program.
Katzenberger says that before the Institute was formed, much of the environmental research was done at the state universities. These universities, he says, are really too departmentalized, and thus wind up inhibiting interdisciplinary study. He says perhaps more than in any other discipline, earth science demands the use of this interdisciplinary research.
Many people in the earth sciences not only would like to know what other people are doing in other disciplines, but they have to know in terms of understanding the earth as a system. That actually one way of describing this new approach would be Earth system science rather than just Earth science.
Recently, the Institute concluded a 3-week-long conference where top scientists and educators met to discuss global environmental issues. Although Katzenberger said it was still too early to discuss the accomplishments of the conference, he was able to give us a reaction to what went on.
I was inspired by the excitement level that the people here had for Not only the content of the different areas that were discussed, but also the process of science itself. And beyond the process and the content, there was also, I think, a very strong cross-fertilization where, for instance, a microbiologist might be talking about bacteria in the muck in the bottom of a freshwater system and how that related to global change. May not have occurred to someone that studies sea ice and glaciers, for instance. And so these almost discoveries of relationship that people had not considered, that I think was a very rich part of the process.
At the present time, Katzenberger and his colleagues at the Aspen Global Change Institute are trying to sort through all the many ideas which were discussed at the conference. So hopefully we will have an update for you in the weeks ahead. For the Environment Show, this is Dan Brody.
Recently, the Environment Show caught up with Mr. William Ruckelshaus. Ruckelshaus was twice the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as acting director of the FBI. He is now chairman of Browning Ferrest Industries, one of the nation's largest waste service companies. Ruckelshaus and his colleagues at BFI introduced a new strategy for their never-ending search for new landfills and recycling centers in New York State. The strategy is really quite simple. In a statewide effort, they have asked communities across the state to work together with BFI to find ways in which their community could site a landfill. This is a new effort, replacing the usual practice of first locating a site and then trying to get the communities to agree.
If a government official says we're interested, then we'll sit down and work with them to develop a community consensus-building program so that the community is fully involved before the decision to go forward and get a site and move to the state is even started, so that we are not relying completely on the governors or the government officials to, in that sense, speak to the people. One of the things that is helpful to the government officials in this process is they don't have to make a judgment right away as to whether this is a good idea. They almost have to if you show up with a site. If you don't have a site, all you have is an idea. Say, let us, working with you, work with the community and see if we can develop a consensus. If no consensus develops, all you have to do is tell us we're not interested, and we'll leave. But if we start with the government being antagonistic and not really understanding what we're doing, then we think probably that also poisons the well.
Ruckelshaus says that as well as increasing landfill capacity, BFI will also increase recycling in an effort to help New York State reach their 57% recycling goal by 1997. He says that their present recycling efforts have proven very marketable across the country.
We haven't had any trouble finding markets for the material that we collect now. We don't anticipate. We have just recently entered into an agreement with Weyerhaeuser to take all the newsprint and old corrugated that we collect on the West Coast. We have an agreement with Alcoa to take all the aluminum. We have an agreement with Wellman, the largest plastic recycler in the country, to take all the plastic that we collect. We don't have trouble finding markets. We can go to cities and say, we can develop these markets for you. We have a nationwide effort at market development. You give it to us and we'll find places for it.
At the present time, Ruckelshaus and BFI are awaiting hopefully positive responses from the communities in New York. And he says that if such responses do prove to be positive, we will probably see such community-oriented siting strategies implemented in states across the country. For the Environment Show, this is Dan Brody. As with all art, music often reflects what is important in the environment around us. As we first introduced in last week's program, John Denver has recently released an album on Windstar Records, in conjunction with the National Wildlife Federation. The album, entitled Earth Songs, is entirely dedicated to songs about the earth. Here is a selection from this album, a song called The Flower That Shattered the Stone.
Our mother just turning around, with the trees in the forest and roots underground. Our father above us, whose sigh is the wind, paint us a rainbow without any end. As the river runs freely, the mountain does rise. Let me touch with my fingers and see with my eyes. In the hearts of the children, a pure love still grows. Like a bright star in heaven that lights our way home. Like the flower that shattered the stone. Sparrows find freedom beholding the sun in the infinite beauty where all's your I reach out before me and look to the sky. Did I hear someone whisper? Did something pass by? As the river runs freely, the mountain does rise. Let me touch with my fingers, see with my eyes. In the hearts of the children, a pure love still grows. Like a bright star in heaven that lights our way home. Like the flower that shatters. Like a bright star in heaven that lights our way home, like the flower that shattered the stone.
John Denver's The Flower That Shattered the Stone off his new album called Earth Songs on Windstar Records. Well, that's our show for this week. I'm Dan Brody, sitting in for Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you'd like to send us a comment or a story idea, of course, they're always welcome. Just send it to The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, and our zip code is 12206. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.